Welcome, everybody. PersonalGrowth.net presents Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom.
Thank you. Today, the topic is gratitude, which is a very important trait to cultivate. From a Jewish standpoint, it's very interesting that the very word to be Jewish, which is Yehudi, which is one of the frequently used words for being a Jew, has as its root the word gratitude. Basically, when Judah, who's the basis of the word Yehudi, was born, his mother, Leah, said, "Hapam Oda Es Hashem," that she was grateful at the birth of her son, Judah, because it showed that she was having more than her fair share of children relative to her counterparts. And she basically named Judah after the concept of being grateful. So it's interesting. When we call ourselves Jews, the reality is that the root word is gratitude. And in fact, in Jewish thought, being grateful to those who are our benefactors is viewed as a central trait. As today's discussion develops, the reasoning behind that is going to become more clear and how fundamental cultivating an attitude that includes gratitude is to our core well-being. Interesting. Research in positive psychology shows that when we express gratitude, two things happen that are very important. One is, in a very almost basic, if not Machiavellian way, it's just smart. Our benefactor is more likely to do good for us in the future when they know that we're being grateful to them for what they did. We've probably all had the experience of helping somebody out, and if that person is appropriately grateful, we just want to help them more in the future. But if they don't show gratitude, if they take an attitude towards us of, "Well, I have it coming to me," we've probably also had the experience of not wanting to help that person out in the future. But then the positive psychology research has another somewhat more subtle kind of finding, maybe even surprising finding, and that's that when we, for example, teach our children to be grateful or ourselves to be grateful, the reality is that the person who expresses gratitude is more likely in turn to pay it forward and to be generous to others, perhaps because it gets us in touch with the good that was done for us and with the whole quality of giving, which in turn then has this almost contagious kind of component to it. The research also shows that those who are prone to build gratitude into their lives have a number of other almost like correlates, personality kind of traits, all of which are positive. The people who are grateful also tend to be more likely to be forgiving, they're less likely to be self-centered, they're better able to control envy, and they tend to be, in general, more agreeable. And as we develop today, it's going to become more clear why all of those positive characteristics are present when one develops the ability to build this into almost like it's an automatic response when good things happen to us. Repeatedly, studies have found that, let's say you give a test measuring a person's capacity for gratitude, and an individual scores high on that test, those people also tend to be the same people who score high on tests of happiness. Beyond that, though, it turns out that what happens while we are being grateful to others, 95 out of 100 people describe having feelings of happiness wash over them as they express feelings of gratitude. And perhaps even more interestingly, over 50% of people say that as they express gratitude, they feel extremely happy. There's something happy-making. There's something joyful. I've sometimes seen people that as they express their gratitude for something that's been done for them, tears well up in their eyes, and those tears, if you ask them, what's the feeling behind those tears? They'll say, oh, those are tears of happiness. Now, let's get a little more practical. Very interesting set of studies done by a team of psychologists headed up by Dr. Emmons, who's one of the leading experts on the positive psychology of gratitude. And what Dr. Emmons has done is a very simple kind of study. He does a 10-week study, and he then assigns people randomly to be in one of three groups. One group is asked to write about five things they were grateful for during the past week. Another group is asked to write about five things that upset them, five annoying things that happened in the past week. And then another group is asked to write about five just things that happened, not things they're grateful for, but five events that affected them during the previous week. And it turns out that of those three groups, the gratitude group, the hassle group, and the five major events group, those in the gratitude group reported some very interesting kinds of general shifts in their mood. One is they felt better about their lives as a whole during this 10-week process where they were getting in touch with five things that they were grateful for during the past week. But not only that, they even, kind of the way they viewed their lives changed. They became more optimistic, more hopeful about the future. They seemed to feel physically better. They reported fewer health complaints, and they even exercised more. Now, it's really a very interesting kind of phenomenon that somehow we have choices in life. We can either develop a capacity to very consciously focus on what we have instead of on what we don't have. And when we do that, we bring on those optimistic, happy, and health-filled feelings. Or we could focus on what we've spoken about in the past, which is the feeling of relative deprivation, to focus on what you don't have. I mean, if you didn't an experiment for yourself where you spent 5 minutes just focusing on something that you're feeling upset about, something that you're jealous about, or something that you're, some event in your life that you feel it's not fair that somebody has more than you and that you have less than somebody else, and see how does that make you feel. And then you spend the same amount of time deliberately just focusing in detail on basic things that you don't even pay attention to. It's amazing what happens. One of the experts in the field, a man named Kretsch, it's a Dr. Greg Kretsch, he has this fascinating exercise that he takes us through. He basically takes us through a day that is destined for disaster from the start. Imagine you're about to go to work on a Monday morning, and somehow something goes wrong with your alarm clock. Your alarm clock was supposed to go off at 6:30 in the morning, and for some reason the battery wears out, and you oversleep. So right away you're in trouble. You're going to be to work late. Then you're in an incredible rush on the way to work, and because you're in such a rush, you get into a minor car accident. Kind of are driving too fast, and you get into a fender bender with a car ahead of you. So now, instead of being an hour late to work, you're going to be 3 hours late to work. And finally, you get to your office, but because you're so late, you can't find a parking spot in the parking lot. Rush into your office close to 4 hours late, and your boss really gives it to you. And now you sit down at your desk in a totally, totally miserable mood. Okay, hopefully we don't have too many days like that in our lives. then Kretsch makes a really interesting kind of comment. He says, okay, that's one scenario for a disastrous Monday morning, but let's look at next Monday morning with a different chain of events, a more typical chain of events. The alarm clock goes off exactly at 6:30, the way it's supposed to. And you get ready and get into your car at exactly 7:30, which is the time you need to get into your car in order to be at the office in time for your 9 o'clock start. And you have a nice drive to work, and you stop off for a leisurely breakfast like you do every morning, and you have your cup of coffee, you have your bagel, you get back into the car, normal patterns of traffic for a Monday morning. And you get to the office, and you park in the spot that's always there for you, and you get in at 5 to 9 the way you usually do. How many people, when a morning starts in that predictable, typical, mundane way, take a step back and say, thank God everything is going so right. Thank God I got to work totally safe and sound. Thank God my alarm clock went off on time. How often are we grateful for the day-to-day kinds of events where things just go smoothly? And that has to do even with the kind of events that take place where we have our body working fine and we have the basic needs for food and shelter and clothing met. It's a very rare person that's able to sustain an ability and what's called a habit of attention, where they focus on what it is that they should be grateful for. It's a very, very difficult thing to do, and I think that that's basically what positive psychology, and for that matter, Judaism, is telling us, that if we can develop that habit of attention, that focus on what we have, it turns out that our happiness levels go up, our benevolence goes up, our optimism level, and even our physical health goes up, because it's always our choice on how much psychological space in our brains is going to be taken up with gratitude for what we have as opposed to resentment for what we don't have. That's the basic concept. And I'm often reminded, let's say you have a favorite pen or a favorite watch or a favorite piece of jewelry, and you lose it, and it's gone. And you're in a pretty bad mood because of that, and you have to go out and buy some kind of a replacement, and it's gone. And you don't see it anywhere for about 2-3 months. And 3 months later, you're cleaning part of your house, and out of, let's say, the inner lining of your sofa comes the excellent, expensive pen that you thought was gone forever. And you put it back in your pocket. Doesn't it feel like it's brand new? Doesn't the newly found watch or piece of jewelry feel brand new? And don't you then walk around with a sense of gratitude about having it, where you suddenly look at it with fresh eyes? Unfortunately, even that will wear off. I remember going on a trip where the airline lost my luggage. I didn't really have anything fresh to wear for 2 days. And I remember how much gratitude I had just for the basic luxury of having fresh clothing when the airline finally delivered my lost suitcase. Almost all of my possessions took on the air of novelty in a way that allowed me to be grateful for things that I'm almost never grateful for. And that's basically what the focus here is on, which is, again, how do we cultivate a fresh look in our lives? It's interesting. C.S. Lewis mentioned in some of his writings that our enjoyment of something will be somewhat restrained unless we are able to express our appreciation for the benefit. That somehow the expression of gratitude completes our enjoyment. But because human nature is habituation, and human nature is to become used to that which we take for granted, it becomes incredibly difficult to sustain it. And that leads to some very interesting research, which is very sad, but I'm sure will resonate with us, which is that we tend to be least grateful to those we're closest to. If we get a flat tire on our car and a good Samaritan stops to help us, human nature is to be incredibly grateful to that stranger for his or her help. But on the other hand, the daily good done for us by a mother, by a father, a husband, a wife, a child, a good friend, is something that's very hard to continue to be grateful for. So the research shows, not surprisingly, that people tend to be more grateful for the unexpected. They experience less gratitude for favors and benefits done to them by those who are closest to them. And that's very sad. By the way, it could be corrected. Some of the positive psychologists say that if we deliberately remind ourselves on a regular basis, spend a little bit of time, if not daily, at least weekly. Okay, let's go through a list of all the things I should be grateful for in my wife. Let's go through a list of all the things I should be grateful for from my mother, from my father, from my friends. Turns out, it actually greatly improves family and social relationships. In marriage, if we deliberately remind ourselves and cultivate the habit of attention to that which we really do need to be grateful for, it actually improves marriages quite a bit, according to the research. And it's an antidote to marital boredom and an antidote sometimes to ongoing marital conflict. It's interesting, in one of the classics of Jewish thought written many centuries ago, a book called The Duties of the Heart, the author of this book in Hebrew is called Chovat Alevavot. He says that our ingratitude even goes to the point of ingratitude to God. He writes the following. He says, people grow up surrounded with the superabundance of divine favors, which because they're experiencing them continuously, they become so used to them and so habituated to them that they come to regard them as entitlements that they forget to be grateful for. Goes on to again say the same thing that I've been focusing on from the beginning today, which is somehow how do we overcome. Our brains are wired in a way to be habituated. I'm reminded of a vacation I took. It's actually a mixture of vacation and business trip where I had to give a paper at a conference on one of the islands of Hawaii. Very, very tough assignment. And I'd never been to Hawaii before, and I was almost going on a beauty overdose. And I remember just relaxing outside, sitting on a chair overlooking one of those unbelievable Hawaiian sunsets and just looking out on this magnificent scene of the water and just magnificent, unparalleled scenery. And I see one of the men who works in the hotel, and I turn to him. I say, wow, are you lucky to work in such an unbelievably beautiful place? I said, I can't even imagine. As a New Yorker who doesn't often see such beauty, I said, I can't even imagine, what's it like to work surrounded by such beauty? And he looked at me kind of confused, maybe even a little bit annoyed. He said, look, listen, sir, he says, to me, this is just a job. I dread going to work Monday morning just like the next guy. And I realized he wasn't seeing what I was seeing. What for me was fresh and unbelievable beauty, for him was just a job. There was nothing wrong with that man. He was actually responding the way our brains are wired to respond. Our brains are wired to become used to even the most magnificent setting and even the most unbelievable ongoing kindness from family members and from our lives surrounding us. It's interesting, and here we start to go a little bit to the levels of recommendations. There's an interesting section in the Talmud that talks about one of the rabbis lived over 1,500 years ago, walking in the marketplace, and he starts screaming out to the people in the market. Who wants life? Who wants life? It's if he was selling life. He's a respected rabbi. His name was Rabbi Alexandri. And of course, everybody, the Talmud tells us, flocks around him. And they're all expectingly looking at him. And he quotes a very well-known passage in the Torah that says, if you want life, you have to be careful about how you treat others and how you talk about others. It was a very well-known passage, something that they've probably heard hundreds of times. What is it that Talmud is trying to tell us here? It's exactly the point that I think I'm making. It's that Rav Alexandri took what for many was probably a well-known and old and tired kind of insight that people weren't even looking at with any kind of attention, and he repackaged it in an exciting way, as the Talmud tells us, in a way that allowed people to look at what for them had become mundane in a new way. And that's what we have to figure out how to do in our lives. How do we develop that habit of attention? Dr. Kretsch calls it the challenge of the ordinary. As he writes, we're inclined to develop a habit of inattention, where we fail to notice that which we are surrounded with that we need to be grateful for. And he goes on to say, the more we perfect a habit of attention, the more successful we will be in conveying gratitude and mastering a sense of happiness. Now, what are some of the impediments to gratitude? I already spoke about how our brains are hardwired to not be able to even see it. And according to research, it's the following three kinds of characteristics, which I think to a certain extent is universal. One is self-preoccupation, where we become so caught up in our own personal life drama that there's little room to notice what's around us, either in terms of the needs of others or in terms of what others have done for us. The other has to do with expectations, where, as I've said before, we expect that which we are accustomed to. And once we develop that expectation, we're no longer surprised or attentive to it. So if a family member is always clearing off the table or doing our laundry or always picking up our laundry or always doing daily kindnesses for us, pretty soon we see it as something that is just part of our lives, so we no longer are surprised when it's done for us, and we're no longer attentive for it. There's, as the psychologist tells, your attention is grabbed only when your expectation is not met, not when it's met. Suddenly, dinner's not on the table when you come home. Suddenly, the laundry's not done. Suddenly, the house isn't as clean as you've come to expect it. And that's when we focus on what's happening rather than focusing on all the good that's happening for us. And the third ingredient is the ingredient of entitlement, which I guess is really what's the real underpinning of this, which is that the more we feel deserving or entitled, the less likely we are to feel grateful for it. A feeling that as long as I feel entitled to something, I won't view anything that's happening to me as a gift or as something that I need to develop gratitude for. So let's start to talk about some ways of trying to build out that habit of attention in our lives. And there are a few basic recommendations I wanted to make. And the first one is the idea that developing that habit of attention takes practice, and it may even take a little bit of ritualizing. We need to somehow build it into our lives, because gratitude develops through continual practice and acknowledgement of the need to do this. And without practice, there's absolutely no guarantee that it's going to become embedded in our repertoire of relating to the world around us. Without literally making it a priority, it's too easy to passively fall victim to that habit of inattention and those three characteristics that foster a lack of gratitude. So recommendation number one is the recommendation that basically is to take perhaps the work that was spoken about earlier, which is the study that the group that either talked about or wrote five things from the week before that they were grateful for had sustained benefits from. And what some people do with that, and some of you may actually have this ritual, it's a wonderful ritual, is that on Friday night, for those of you who have a Friday night Shabbat meal or some weekly meal, but in my house it's on Friday night, that on Friday night you go around the table and you ask every family member to discuss five things that they're grateful for. And you just ask, please tell me five things that you're grateful for, or perhaps, and this is maybe even more doable, what we do actually is not five, we just do say, tell me one highlight of the week that you're grateful for, because people aren't as burdened by one. We go around the table and we talk about one thing from the week we're grateful for, and it has two benefits. One benefit is that it lets the rest of the family know something from the week that they might not know about otherwise. And the research shows that the more one shares the intimate details of their regular lives with family members, the better we do together in terms of forming a cohesive sense of family, and the better we do in general in terms of being able to deal with challenges that are come our way in a way that there's more of a bond and more of a sense of cohesiveness. So that's the recommendation number one. Let me tell you a story about this, which really brought it home for me. I was on a visit to Israel where I was giving a series of talks. It was actually during a very stressful time in Israel. It was the height of the Intifada there, where there was a lot of bombings. And I was asked to do some work there since my main area in terms of my psychological specialty as a psychologist is working with post-traumatic stress disorder. And it was during that period of time that there was a lot of need for work in that area in Israel. And I was spending time in the country. And I was running out of Israel to catch a flight to the United Kingdom where I had to attend a conference. And then I was going to go home for the weekend. So I'm in a cab on the way to the airport to catch a flight to England and then later that week back home. And I remembered that a friend of ours had invited us to their daughter's wedding, which was going to be in Jerusalem, that day. Actually, right at that point when I was taking the cab from Jerusalem to the airport. And I told my friend that I couldn't make the wedding because it was a little bit tight, the plane connection. And I told the cab driver, you know something, can you please pull to a hotel in this area? I'd like to just make a stop. I'll pay you for the waiting time. So I figured, let me at least run in and congratulate my friend and congratulate the bride and the groom. And I figured I could probably make my plane anyway. So the cab driver takes me, and it turns out that the marriage ceremony had already started, and it was outside. And it was set in this magnificent setting on the lawn outside, and the setting was unbelievable. The sun was setting over the ancient stones of the old city of Jerusalem. So there's these ancient walls surrounding the old city, and the sun is setting, and there's something golden about that unbelievable view of the sun setting over this ancient city that has so much meaning. And the bride and groom were probably the happiest bride and groom I ever saw in my life. They were literally jumping with joy. And there was something about the combination of the perfect weather, the perfect, unbelievably spiritual and beautiful setting of the sun setting over this ancient, beautiful city, and the unbelievable joy of the bride and groom, it just got to the audience, and everybody's sitting watching this unbelievable ceremony. There isn't a dry eye at the ceremony. Everybody's just crying. It was really tears of meaning and tears of joy. I was so happy that I stopped to spend at least a little bit of time at this wedding. And I sneak out the back after the ceremony's over. I run back to the cab, and I make it to the airport, to Ben Gurion Airport, and just make the plane just in time. Plane takes me to England, and I have a very tense couple of days there at a conference that I was needing to give a bunch of talks. And I finally catch a plane back to JFK in New York, where I live, and I make it to my house on Friday afternoon, just in time for Shabbat, just in time. And I'm exhausted, and I'm jet-lagged. And I come in, and we're sitting with the family having our Friday night Shabbat dinner. And my wife, who tries to keep me honest, looks around at the family, at my kids, and she says, okay, let's talk about one thing from the week that we're grateful for. And I wanted to kill her. I was exhausted. I just wanted to go to sleep. The last thing I wanted to do was to do this gratitude exercise. And she goes around, you know, my children each talk about one thing from the week that they're grateful for. The time they were all teenagers, very much resisted the exercise. But they got into it. They don't resist it anymore. Adolescents hate the exercise at the beginning, but then they see the value of it. And they're going around. And finally, it's up to me. I was going to be the last one. And in spite of my fatigue, what suddenly flashes through my mind was that scene at the wedding. I'd forgotten about it. It was such an unbelievably busy couple of weeks with all that had happened in Israel and all that happened to me in England that I'd forgotten about that unbelievable episode at that very special moment at the wedding ceremony. And I start telling my family about that experience of watching the sunset and of the bride and of the groom and of that very special moment. And as I described that moment that I was so grateful for, two things happened. One is my wife and my kids heard about something that happened to me that was very important. But I also felt it lodging and going from short-term memory to long-term memory. I think I would have forgotten it otherwise. But it became part of me. It became a moment that I can now summon up when I need to think about something spiritual and positive that happened. And that's, I think, in a way, the essence of gratitude, the essence of developing that habit of attention. And I think it could only happen with building it into that kind of family ritual in whatever way you can. Interestingly, one of the researchers in the field of positive psychology has made the point, and a very important point, that somehow if you just do these exercises once a week instead of once a day, it has an even more powerful impact. So that's my first recommendation. Recommendation number two is actually a little bit of a counterintuitive one, but it has to do with the power of mistakes, how we handle our mistakes. And this, again, is something that's been described as helpful in developing the characteristic of gratitude in our lives. As one of the authors in the field of psychology, positive psychology, says, and I quote, "As long as I am humbled by my own mistakes or limitations, I am more likely to receive what I am given with gratitude and a true sense of appreciation for the giver as well as the gift." Meaning, it takes a certain amount of humility to be able to be grateful, to be able to really open up to the fact that we're dependent on others and need to be aware of what others do for us. It takes an awareness of one's own needs and one's own vulnerabilities in order to develop this. Let me tell you about a fascinating study done at University of Pennsylvania that when I heard this study, it actually impacted on the way I relate to others in a pretty regular kind of way. It's a study where a sociologist at Penn Medical School did a study where he compared the top 1% of neurosurgeons to the bottom 1%. So the top 1%, these are people who have incredibly long training. So you have the 4 years of medical school. And then after all of that, you have, years and years of general surgery. And then you specialize further until you become an independently practicing brain surgeon, neurosurgeon. So after all those years of training, he looked at who is it at the top 1%, those neurosurgeons who have the lowest death rate, people die on the table the least, they have the best success with their surgeries. And then he compared them to the bottom 1% of neurosurgeons, those who are so bad that they actually are fired by their residency programs. It turns out that when they look at what differentiated the top from the bottom, it wasn't manual dexterity, which one would have expected. It wasn't IQ score. It wasn't even the medical school or the residency program that the neurosurgeon went to. It wasn't any of those things. It was how the surgeon handled his or her mistakes when they lost a patient. The top 1% neurosurgeon, if they lost a patient, they would be energized by the experience, not in a positive way, but they would not rest till they found out what it was that they did wrong. And they change it from setback to feedback. So they'd run to the library to read every possible article to see whether or not they missed something. They'd call colleagues or more experienced people in the field to ask away at what might have been done differently. They'd go to the animal lab to experiment over and over again till they totally understood what it was that they could do different for the future. If you read the transcripts of the surgeons from the bottom 1%, it's chilling. It'll be things like, well, of course I lost that patient. It's a terrible nursing staff in the operating room. Or, of course I lost that patient. This hospital has the worst lighting in their operating room. And it was all about seeing the mistakes as something that was externalized and the fault of others. So it turns out that part of developing the habit of attention and part of developing gratitude is actually the ability to recognize the power of one's mistakes, recognize one's inherent limitations and dependence on others. And when one does that, one is more likely to then be open to what others do for us and to receive what you're given with gratitude. So that's recommendation number two. A little counterintuitive, but I think it's actually important. Now, the final set of recommendations just has to do with parenting recommendations. How does one teach our children to be grateful? And there, it's a little more obvious. Part of it is that parents have to learn how to model behavior by showing gratitude in our own lives. Every time we thank a cab driver or thank somebody who helps us out in our home or at a restaurant, maybe we treat a waiter, and a sincere expression of gratitude towards others, even towards our children when they do something they're asked to do, is something that helps teach children, kind of weaves the lesson of gratitude into their daily lives. So taking that extra moment to thank a sales clerk or the person who's delivering the newspaper, and to perhaps even more importantly, to remind children to thank us for what they may take for granted, be it helping them with homework or giving them a lift to a friend's house. Children really do need to be reminded to say thank you, and parents need to be reminded not to say don't mention it. And they should resist any, inadvertent sabotage by saying, that's okay. Okay? And instead, kids should be praised for expressing gratitude. And I think that's a very important piece. It's interesting. There's a practice in Japan called Naikan, Naikan, where they also, from a cultural standpoint, build gratitude into the fabric of people's lives as a way of just sort of relating to the world around them. And they have people who practice Naikan ask themselves the same three questions on a daily basis. One question is, what have I received from others? The second question is, what have I given to others? And the third question is, what troubles and difficulties have I caused others? And I think that that is basically the essence of what we need to be doing as we try to overcome a natural tendency towards habituation and develop the habit of attention to all that which is good, which surrounds us. Thank you.
Thank you very much. If there are any questions, please press star six. Dr. Popovitz, you mentioned when you started that the, Jewish has to do with the word Yehudi and Judah. I had a question, is that related to the word Judaism as well?
Yes, absolutely. So the word Yehudi is literally the root of the word Judaism, and that's what I was meaning by Judaism having at its core the need to recognize what others do for us.
And in the Hebrew language, the word for gratitude is also the word for acknowledgement. Is there a relationship between the two?
Absolutely right. So hodah or odeh, you know, acknowledgement is basically it's the acknowledgement to acknowledge what others have done for us. So again, it's basically, and that takes a certain amount of humility, and it also takes developing that habit of attention.
Mm-hmm. And the habit of attention, if one works on that, can that become a habit that works like our other habits where we don't have to monitor it?
No, I think that probably not. I think it needs to be monitored. That's why I said, you know, it's kind of, we need to remind ourselves, and probably rituals help, you know, building in rituals around like that Friday night dinner ritual. You know, I think that without somehow building it into the fabric of your lives, it's interesting. Prayer in Jewish thought, a chunk of what's behind prayer is gratitude. So if prayer has to do with three parts in Jewish thinking. So, you know, part of prayer has to do with praising God. Part of prayer has to do with asking for things that we need. But another part is thanking, is, you know, to be thankful for what we have. So one who really gets into that component of prayer is building it into the daily fabric of their lives. And that's another way that it's you know, kept going.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, thank you. So the next topic is going to be forgiveness, which is the next section, and that'll be our next focus will be forgiveness.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining PersonalGrowth.net, Personal Growth and Positive Psychology Through the Prism of Ancient Jewish Wisdom, by Dr. David Pelkovitz, Ph.D.